building your life from the ground up, and sometimes subterraneanly, as it were. Well, my next guest, is going to be talking a little bit about that, as well as many of the things that he is going to be leaving behind for generations to come. My guest is Alan Lapidus. The book is Everything by Design, My Life as an Architect. And we're going to talk about the architectural aspects of life.
Talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Understanding what an architect is and does is part of the program today, and my guest is going to be talking about that. One of the quotes, my buildings are my babies, my legacy. When I watch one of them going up, or when I pass a structure I designed, the sense of awe and wonder is almost indescribable. They will be there long after I'm gone to explain in a universal language to generations as yet unborn how we lived, and it is a feeling unlike any other. For this, I am grateful. And I'm grateful to have you, Alan Lapidus, on our program. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Some folks are going to kind of wonder, well, how does an architect fit into this concept of new paradigms for a new world? Well, the fact of the matter is that Alan and his father as well have been designing and building buildings for, I don't know what, 40, 50, 60, 70, how many years?
Well, my father started in 1926, and I started in 1963. So between us, we cover most of the past century.
And with that, we have all kinds of structures. I sometimes wonder, though, you know, the comment that I made in regards to your quote about these buildings will be here long after I am gone. Some folks would kind of cringe a little bit at that, say, that's like styrofoam, well, sort of, kind of. And we're going to get into that a little bit, too, as far as what it is that you are leaving behind, your legacy, as we all are sort of searching for that aspect of not only wanting to make a difference while we're here, but hopefully maybe we can even make a difference after we're gone. We hear of the anthropologists, I believe it is, who dig up the remains of and ruins of old civilizations to try to see how they live. And I sometimes wonder what that's going to be like, you know, when we're gone, and if we can look into the looking glass, peering down or wherever it is we are, and saying, why do they care about how we lived then? It was such a bad time. Things in our day were not so great, and things are better. Well, we hope they are actually better even today. You became interested in architecture at how early an age?
Quite late, actually. I was always trying to figure out what to do with my life. My very first thing was to be a radio announcer, if that sounds familiar. And then I was... I really loved writing, and so I was going to be a writer. And my one of my claims to fame was that I was elected class writer of my high school class, which doesn't sound like much, except in my high school class was Woody Allen and Eric Siegel, the author of Love Story. I loved writing, but found myself I was writing about architecture all the time. My father, of course, was one of the best-known architects of the mid-20th century and latter 20th century. And I just couldn't get away from it in my writing, and I decided I might as well see what this is about. And I went to architectural school, and I started writing 50 years later.
Well, and some of us do have to wait. I sometimes wonder about memoirs. I'm not sure if there's a cutoff age where you're, oh, it's okay, now you can write it because you've crossed this line. I don't know if a kid of 20 can write his memoirs. He hasn't lived enough yet.
Exactly. Or is wise enough. I mean, I figured out the definition, at least for me, of wisdom, which is intelligence coupled with experience. And I think after 50 years, I got the experience.
Well, now that sheds new light on the phrase that was actually tossed at me at the age of 21, because I was asking all kinds of intriguing questions. At least they were intriguing to me. And that was the comment, you're wise beyond your years. And now, with what you've added to it, it's a little scary. I'm thinking, you know, I think they were wrong.
Exactly.
I hadn't lived enough yet, hadn't experienced quite enough yet at the age of 21.
Oh, absolutely.
But I do appreciate the compliment nonetheless. Now, you have been designing and I guess we could say building buildings, though you don't necessarily get in there and put the hammer in hand and a nail into the wood or
right.
rivets into the steel. Here we are, we're talking 40 some odd years.
Right.
How has your perspective, your attitude, if you will, or your perception, if you will, of designing buildings, how have you seen it change and shift as we have shifted from a very industrialized and business-oriented country in particular? Because I'm going to guess that you've designed mostly here in the United States.
In the United States, but also pretty much all over the world.
Okay. Then we'll do a global. How has that changed over the years for you? And where are you today as far as the mindset of coming up with the concepts for buildings today versus, say, 30 or 40 years ago?
Well, I think the difference is two things. One is the world changes, and two, as I change, when I was a fresh kid right out of architectural school, I think every kid coming out of architectural school wants to use a phrase, make his bones. I'm going to design a building that's going to make everybody stop and look and say, terrific, and it's going to be published. It's very ego-driven because young men and young women, they want to show what they've got. And so what was guiding me in those days was that people would know my work. And then I think what changed was I realized that I was building people. I was building places for people. And something that my father said suddenly took hold, because most of our work is hotels, resorts, things of that sort, places for people to enjoy themselves or a place away from home to stay, and hopefully it'll be a kind environment. And my father told me that when I started designing hotels, he said, always design for your client's clients. In other words, don't design for the person who's paying you to design the building, because they probably have so much money if they can do that, that they're not staying in their own hotel. Design for the people who are actually using it. Stop for a moment and think, who's coming here and what do they expect? And I think I started listening more and observing people and becoming a student of human behavior so that I could really accommodate that in the buildings. And at the same time, the buildings have changed, because when I went to architectural school, that was that strange time in the late 50s and early 60s, when the establishment thought that the unadorned glass box was the height of architectural wonder. And now, as time has passed, people look at these glass cubes without any soul and without any life and shudder. And so people have begun to look for buildings that treat them a little bit better.
And, you know, you made a comment, you talk about the legacy, of course, and in that light of, you know, these buildings of that day and the awe and wonder then, and of course nowadays it's like, no big deal. And so, and then it kind of begs the question, how do you now design a building that will not only withstand the test of time, but maybe even in the case of the test of nature, as well as from an aesthetic standpoint, be something that will be complementary to the surroundings for literally for years to come? That is like, well, you know, we'll have this and we'll build it and it'll be here for 10 years. And just like fashion, we'll tear it down and we'll build something that's of the fashion of that day in 10 years.
Unfortunately, that is exactly what is happening more and more in architecture. I mentioned as a young man, I wanted to design something that would make people say, ooh, look at that. And that's happening, unfortunately, more and more, where people are building disposable architecture. One of my clients, when I was designing the building, and he said, that air conditioning system is a little too elaborate, because I wanted something that would not only heat and cool, but also add humidity to the air so people don't get colds and things like that. Just trying to think of the people who would be in the building. And I said, well, look, the system that you have is really going to fall apart in 5 or 10 years. These were condominiums, by the way, that people were going to live in as their homes. And he said, I really don't care, because I'm going to sell the building before 5 years. 5 years are out. I'll make my fortune and let whoever's living in it care for that. And that, unfortunately, happens a lot, and is one of the reasons why I decided to not to follow that type of architecture and not do that kind of thing. It's very much, a lot of things are built for the quick buck and the devil take the hindmost.
There was a video that I saw on the internet not too long ago about disposable stuff or something of that nature, but it had to do with consumptionism and when it started shortly after World War II and the built-in obsolescence. And so you are telling me that it may not have been there back in, say, the 50s or 60s, but it started to creep in more and more, as you've just described. Is that indeed, as you've stated, really becoming more and more prevalent? Or because people are more concerned about the environment, because people are more concerned about sustainable living areas and so forth for years to come, is that shifting, or is it really still just the disposable architecture as you describe it?
Well, it's not monolithic. In certain areas, the disposable architecture, I'll make my bucks building the building and selling it, is very prevalent, especially in big urban centers, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. In those areas, people are so money-driven that they do indeed do that. But in other areas, it doesn't quite hold true. And in sustainable, we were talking before we went on the air a little bit about green buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a whole new field. One, I'm overjoyed the fact that people are finally taking it into their consciousness, that we live on a planet that can't just keep on, just throwing stuff away. And I had one example of that, which was probably the most fascinating building I ever did in my life. And the client was, of all people, the Nature Conservancy. And since I design resorts, primarily in different countries and all of that, they approached me with a proposition, and they said what they would like to do is build a 4-star resort complete with television and air conditioning and everything, in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest, except I couldn't use any power, I couldn't use any fossil fuels, I couldn't leave behind any waste. It had to be completely environmentally neutral. And there was no source of natural power, electric, fossil fuel, anything. In other words, here is a primitive forest that's been that way since the beginning of the earth, and out of nothing, build a 4-star resort. Their logic was that they've got a lot of wonderful little sort of huts in the jungle in Belize and places like that where people can experience nature. And they said, in that case, what we're doing is preaching to the converted. Nobody comes there unless they're already an environmentalist. What we want to do is create a resort for people who are not primarily interested in that but are curious, and give them an experience where they have all the luxuries they used to, but they're right in the middle of God's own nature. And that was a challenge, and we did it. And we did it in a kind of interesting way. I was down in Brazil and working with some of their engineers and also with the conservancy people, and went to the site, and it really was the prehistoric world. I mean, it's an astounding sight to see that, where the root systems of the trees were way higher than I was. And up here I'm regarded as an architect. Down there I was regarded as lunch by everything that was crawling, slithering, and swimming. And I said, okay, this is a challenge. And we did it. And the way we did it, and this, I think I'm beginning to see this happening little by little more and more, is I realized that if we could create a huge amount of electric current, we could have everything we ever wanted in a resort. And so working with the engineers in Brazil, and Brazil, by the way, is probably one of the most ecologically amazing country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, they don't import any oil. They run on fuel made from their sugar cane.
Mm-hmm. Yes, is what I hear.
And they are aware of it. And so we devised a system where we had three means of power, one of which was we had two problems. We couldn't leave behind any waste. The primary thing, of course, is, to put it indelicately, human waste.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to have power. And they said, hey, one leads to the other. And what they did was they had something down there which we developed called the biodigester. And this was a huge tank where all the sewage from the hotels went into it. And when that decomposes, I know most of us have smelled sewer gas. It smells like rotten eggs. And that's hydrogen sulfide. That's the natural byproduct of decomposition. And the operative word is hydrogen. This thing is pure, practically pure hydrogen. So you tap the gases coming out of that tank and feed it to a burner, which you ignite. It produces a huge flame. You boil water. The steam coming off that turns a turbine, and you've got electricity. So you've just disposed of human waste and created an enormous amount of electricity. The other thing we did was it was on the Amazon River, and on that river there's always a 5 to 10 knot wind coming down the Amazon. And so we put wind turbines out over the river, which created a lot of electricity. And the third system was what we call tidal dams. In other words, the Amazon has a tide of 10 feet twice a day. That river rises and falls 10 feet. So when the river rises, it spills off into these huge reservoirs. And when the river recedes, the water from the reservoirs spill out over water wheels, which are, in fact, turbines, which create electric power. We have more electricity than you could ever shake a stick at. So we can have air conditioning, all the amenities, and to explore the rainforest. We had paths going through there, and we had, like, golf carts that would be recharged every night so people could go into the depths of the rainforest perfectly comfortably, making no sound and no pollution, and have a great time. It was a totally self-sustaining building.
So you have no high-tension wires or pipelines going to or from that facility?
Nothing. And the byproduct of the biodigester is a sludge that has no odor and is the best nitrogen fertilizer in the world, which they sell. This is a totally self-sustaining project.
That is phenomenal, and that is one of the things that we are going to be delving into in future programs as well. We're going to get into the buildings and structures, things of this nature, as well as other means. I'm actually investigating myself rain harvesting. We just had 10 inches of rain up where I live above Santa Barbara, California, and I could only cringe as the rain was falling, going, I'm missing so much, but that day will come too. And of course, you have to have a place to put it all and then do something with it once you have collected it so that you don't have problems associated with standing water. But again, these are the types of things, and we're also going to get into health and wellness and other areas as well as we continue talking about new paradigms for a new world here on Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we're talking today with the author of Everything by Design. And you know, folks, everything is by design. We may not know who the heck the designer is sometimes. Some of the buildings you drive by, you don't know who the designer was, although some of them could have been designed by our guest, Alan Lapidus. And we're talking with him today and referring to his memoirs. The book is available at your local bookstore at Amazon.com. You can go to my website, RichardDugan.com, and there's a link there on the show's page, not only to some information about Alan's book, but also to this interview. Once this interview is over, about 5-10 minutes past, it will be available for you to listen to share with your friends and family and so forth, and say, look, there are people who are in the business world, who are in the business of designing and creating the structures that we see and live in and work in every day, who really are working towards designing things that are more not just aesthetically pleasing, but environmentally congruent, shall we say. And we are most appreciative of that. And I love the example of the building, the resort that you built down in Brazil that you've just described. That, to me, is that's thinking outside the box. I'm hoping that kind of thinking outside the box is starting to spread like a virus amongst the designers.
Well, it's going to have to, because the thing is that we are now so dependent on energy, and what we don't realize, of course, is that it's all around us. We just have to, as you said, harvest it. I had started thinking along this way because I did designing resorts. A lot of the resorts were in the Caribbean on islands that basically had no water and very little rainfall. And so we began, so conserving water was absolutely paramount. In fact, in the American Virgin Islands, which originally were Danish, recognizing that fact, law going back 300 years to the Danish colonies said that every building had to have a certain amount of roof, and they gave the formula for if the building is this big, you have to have this much roof. It had to be an impervious tile, and all of the water that fell off the roof had to be collected in cisterns underneath the building, or you didn't get to build the building. So from the get-go, and we're now going back hundreds of years, they knew about water conservation and harvesting water, and that was something that they did. And because of the scarcity of water in our resorts, We use what's called total energy systems over there, which was the beginning of what I was talking about there, where all the water from the wastewater from the hotel, not the sewage water, but we've had what we call the gray water system. That's the water from the sinks, the water from the laundry, etc., was all sent into a treatment plant, and sometimes the sewage, too, if you had a tertiary plant. And the water there was treated extensively, treated and filtered, etc. And then this water was then used for things like watering the lawn and laundry. The water was potable, although people would be put off if they, they knew where it was coming from. But all the uses, it was recirculated into the toilets. It was recirculated into the laundries. It was recirculated into all the water that was used for watering. And so that was of necessity because you didn't have water.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to figure it out. And if people don't have something that they need, they'll figure out a way to do it. It's just people are now beginning to realize we may not have all this good stuff in a few years. So they're beginning to look at technology that has existed for hundreds of years.
Well, even as a kid growing up, I would watch the weather, weather forecasts. I'd watch the news reports as the weather changed from season to season. And of course, the top story was always in the wintertime. And Buffalo, New York has had 15 feet of snow dumped on her. The one thought that always went through my mind, whether it was rain or snow, but specifically snow, was there are thousands of square miles of snow that is going to eventually melt, and then it's going to run off into the little cracks and crevices, the streams, and down into the rivers, and then out into the ocean, if it's like going down the Mississippi, what have you. And I'm thinking, if they were just to even take that which they removed from the roadways to clear it for traffic, and they were to haul that away off into a collection area and let that just naturally melt over the course of time, then we would not have had the problems, let's say, back down in Georgia this past October that they had, the crisis they had down there, which I guess they're still sort of facing. It's not a done deal yet. But why not take some of the snow from the Rockies or from, you know, Utah or what have you? Yes, there's costs involved with transporting it and so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, weigh that against the ability of a particular area of a population center not to have water specifically. We can go without food for a number of days, I've heard, or even weeks, but you can't go for days without water.
Right. Exactly.
And this is just ingesting water. We're not talking about washing your clothes or washing your car. I mean, it would solve so many problems if we would just learn how to do that. And you don't need to put in pipelines. I mean, it's not that kind of a situation. But that was something I was even thinking about as a kid.
Well, that's exactly it, because and that's something that the Danes were thinking about in the Virgin Islands in the 1700s. And the first law that they wrote was how to take the water that falls and conserve it and use it. It's interesting. Necessity, in fact, is the mother of invention. And I think we're getting to the point in our country now where it's becoming a necessity.
It really is. And the thing about it is that people are beginning to think in these ways. And fortunately, they're not, I believe we have not reached critical mass yet, although that seems to be the case in human existence, that it's not until we reach critical mass that we come up with solutions. People are not panicking right now. They're calmly and collectively coming up with solutions, with new ways of looking at things and doing things. I mean, we live at the top of a hill, and I am very mindful of the people who live downhill from me. And I may not know them, but I know there are people that live downhill. Well, you just can't throw anything and everything on the ground and figure it's just going to sit there. No, because when those kinds of rains with 6 and 8 and 10 inches come, it's going to wash that downhill towards those people. Well, what if I was living downhill above it? How would I feel about that? I want to grow things on my land, and I've got animals, and I've got this and that and the other. So I think that, again, this concerted effort, this calm, cool, and diligent process that we're going through, I think is very good. I was wondering, too, as far as you mentioned the wind turbines, going back to the example of the resort down in Brazil, the wind turbines, and then, of course, this using the tides and these reservoirs and putting in these water wheels, how much of an impact do those devices, if you will, make on the landscape? I mean, are they even really that noticeable?
They really aren't, because it's the type of thing that it's the same way that when we first strung telegraph wires and then telephone wires all across the country, at first they're saying, how could you possibly do with that ugly poles and those wires, et cetera, et cetera. And now they're just a piece of the landscape that everybody takes for granted. I mean, nobody sees a telephone pole and says, oh, my God, it's a blight upon our society. but they sure did when they put them in at first. And the turbines are the same thing. And when I mentioned the tidal dams that we use for power, by the way, that was not an original idea of mine. It's just that I love history, and that's how the colonists in New York's Long Island got their power, because unlike New England, where you had surging rivers that could turn water wheels and provide power, all New York had really was the Great South Bay and New York Harbor and the coastline. They didn't have a lot of rivers. And the tidal dams were invented by the colonists in the early 1700s as a means of providing power to, in that case, it wasn't electricity, but it was to grind corn and saw logs and things like that. They saw a need for power. They looked at the tide, and they figured it out. And these are people who were basically farmers and merchants, you know, living on Long Island when you still had, the Indians running around. And they figured out a way of providing power. Humans are wonderfully resourceful. They, as long as they're pushed into something that where they have to do it. And I think one of the byproducts of higher energy costs is a wake-up call to stop relying upon imported oil as energy, because we're surrounded by sources of power. It's time to use them. And even to the point now where everybody talks about green buildings, and green buildings are wonderful, but they are more expensive than other buildings. But you will make up that expense in a number of years because of lower energy costs, because you lower the cost of providing energy for the building. And as long as energy is cheap, nobody cared about that. Now that energy is getting more expensive, people are saying, well, maybe if I spent initially more money on the building and it pays me back in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, however many it is, at that point, my energy, outside energy use is diminishing. You've got to get over the idea that the initial cost frightens people off, because the long term is what counts.
Yeah. One of the areas that I was just thinking about as you were describing the difference between many of the buildings that we've built over the centuries and the green buildings that we're working on today, at least here in this country, the image of smokestacks came into my mind. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it always struck me strange that we had these huge factories, for example, that would spew out this smoke, not knowing what's in it. And I was always of the mindset whenever I was out camping with the family that I did not want to sit in the spot around the fire when the smoke was blowing in my direction. And that's just smoke from, that's just the ash coming up from the wood that we're burning that we collected from around the campsite. So why is it that we would spew the smoke into the air? Because we do have to breathe that. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And it just seems to me that nobody ever seemed to want to put those two things together. It's the same thing with cigarette smoking. I mean, look, I want to get away from the smoke from the campfire, but I'm going to go over here and I'm going to light this little paper wound tobacco thing and inhale smoke into my lungs. You know, regardless of all of the scientific health hazards that they have found of cigarette smoking, even if it was a piece of pine sawdust that they'd wound into this thing, I wouldn't want to inhale the smoke into my lungs. It just doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, people are kind of wonderful in their ability to deny the obvious. it's really true. I mean, at first when the Industrial Revolution started and you had a few factories spewing smoke, well, first of all, there were just a few factories and the rest of the country was farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, oh, it's not doing any harm, but it's providing employment and it's producing all this wonderful stuff. And then we got the mindset that, of course, that factories and smokestacks were terrific because it's providing us great stuff. And when you only had 10, 100, 1,000 in this vast country of ours, it was no big deal. Then it's kept going, and nobody thought to say, well, wait a minute. We're saying wait a minute now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me delve into an area here that I'm very interested in as we do these programs each week. We have various guests on talking about so many different areas of an esoteric and a spiritual nature of people who are striving to change the consciousness of our communities and our society and even our world as we are talking here today, that is changing within architecture and design as we move forward. How have you observed yourself and your own mindset and your own guiding light, if you will, changing over the years as you've designed buildings?
Well, the thing is that this has been actually one of the keys to the entire profession of architecture, is that Winston Churchill once said very famously, "We form our buildings, and then our buildings form us." Architecture has been used from time immemorial to shape the way we think, we feel, we interact, and the way our societies go. And this goes back to the ancient times. The Romans built their grand public buildings to establish for the first time the power of the state. They were the first ones because they were the first real powerful city-state. And they did it with their architecture. They would build these huge temples and forums, and people would approach them with respect. You don't go into one of those wonderful Roman buildings and say, "Oh, great, let's play cards." I mean, it's like, oh, this is the big guy.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, every civilization, usually dictatorships, unfortunately, the first thing they do is build. And Rome actually projected its power all over the world, not so much by its legion, because you didn't, if you were doing going about your business, your everyday business, say, in North Africa, you weren't passing 4,000 legionnaires in shining armor. What you did see was the huge baths and forums and imperiums that were there and saying, "These guys obviously know what they're doing, and you better not cross them." They projected power with architecture. And when you talk about spiritual, that's where architecture reached its zenith, was in building the great cathedrals, the mosques, the temples, that gave people an idea that there was a force larger than themselves. And you go right back to the Greeks. If you have to put yourself in the mindset, say, let's use Chartres Cathedral in France, which was built in roughly the 1300s, that you had your average French peasant, and that area was a low, flat farmland. The biggest structure that anybody had ever saw was usually the hut they lived in, which had a 7-foot ceiling and a dirt floor. Maybe the local lord had even a 2-story building, and that was a pretty spectacular thing. Then you suddenly walked into Chartres Cathedral, 150 feet high, soaring arches that were pointed on top, so it swung your eye right up, your neck immediately snapped back as your eye looked up into the gauzy haze of this huge, intricate lacework of stone, light coming in through the stained glass windows, the rose window, illuminating everything. And you were a true believer. It was the 13th century version of LSD, really, because you were just knocked out. But it inspired a sense of awe and reverence and religion. And it's why when you go into a cathedral or some of the spectacular mosques or temples, you immediately feel reverential. And yes, it's the philosophy, but it's also the architecture. My own theory is that if it wasn't for the Gothic cathedral, most of us would still be worshiping wood sprites, because it focuses your mind, and it's always been used that way. And it's amazing how, and it's a hidden thing. It's not something you're quite aware of. When we go into certain buildings, we feel good or we feel bad. But buildings alter the way we are. If you spend your days working in a soulless glass box, with those glass ceilings and with the glass walls and the acoustic tile ceiling and fluorescent lights, it really does a great job of messing up your soul.
Mm.
Whereas if you work in a space that's fun, is pleasant, the air is good, you're more productive, you feel happier, and it's a better life. And your life is being directly affected by architecture, and it always has been. I mean, there are plenty of buildings that don't inspire anything except boredom in people, but the ones that do work can change your lives and have changed our lives.
Do you find that the process of designing for you is a spiritual experience?
Extremely, because what I have to be able to do is put myself in the mind of the person who is entering the building. My father's dictum, always design for your client. And it's a wonderful, the field that I'm in is a wonderful field for human behavioral experimentation because I design resorts. And people come there to have a good time. And, you know, you can see that in a lot of resort areas, it's the same beach, it's the same sunshine, it's the same ocean. The buildings are different. So in some buildings, when you go on a vacation, you say, this is terrific, I'm having a great time. In others, it's okay. You know, the water's great. A lot of it depends upon the building. It's an interesting change in architecture because my father was given the commission in the early 1950s where someone came to him and said, I want to do a hotel in Miami Beach, because Miami Beach hadn't been very much built up till then. This is in the early 50s. There were a couple of the classic old hotels of the Biltmore and things like that. And they said that they wanted to design the most magnificent, the greatest, most gorgeous hotel in all of America, which is a pretty tall order. And my father sat back, and this is where his true genius lay, and said, whose idea of gorgeous? He said, you know, what's the idea, whose idea of a wonderful hotel? Now, my father was the typical American Horatio Alger story. He came to the United States as a babe in arms with his parents, lived on the Lower East Side, didn't speak English till he was 6 years old, hardscrabble world of outdoor privies in New York City, by the way, which is what the tenements had, clawed his way up and became an architect. And so here he was in 1951 being told to design the most gorgeous hotel, thinking of whose frame of reference gorgeous was. And he realized up till then the idea of a magnificent hotel would be the Breakers or the Biltmore or the Waldorf. And he realized that, you know, when he went into those buildings, he felt out of place. These were for the old aristocracy of the United States, the Vanderbilts or the Vanderbilt wannabes. And as a slum kid from New York, he just felt terribly out of place. And he looked around and he said, I'm designing this hotel for people like me. Because the United States, for the first time in the 1950s, Americans had money to take a vacation. Because prior to that, in the early 20s, the wealthy traveled, the poor went to Coney Island or Atlantic City or wherever they could reach by a shortest means possible because they didn't have cars. Then the Depression came along, which was disastrous, and then World War II, and now it was 1950. The country had had full employment. For the first time, the American middle class had money to travel. And he realized he was the American middle class, and he sat and said, where did I get my idea of wonderful and gorgeous? And he realized it was in the movies, in the 1930s Busby Berkeley movies. he remembered watching, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dancing across these shining floors with these curving staircases. And he said, that was where my generation got their idea of wonderful. And he built the Fontainebleau Hotel. Now, if you've ever been to the Fontainebleau and can rent an old copy of Gold Diggers of 1933, you'll see the building in there.
Mm.
It was understanding what these people thought was terrific, and these people were with him.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a new America that was arising, and he was able to tap into it and the Fontainebleau, which was opened in 1954, is still the gold standard of fun hotels. He designed a building that enabled people and gave people permission to smile and have fun. You walk into the Waldorf, you're not thinking of smiling and having fun. but you walk into one of his hotels or one of my hotels, and the smile comes to your face, and you said, I'm going to have a great time here.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. One of the wonderful bookend experiences of the father-son team was that the first James Bond film was Goldfinger. And they, of course, the entire opening of the book is filmed at the Fontainebleau to give an idea of the elegance and terrific and sun and fun. And there is James Bond on the pool deck and having a great time. The next James Bond film was Thunderball. And the last part of that film was filmed at one of my resorts, the El Conquistador. So I guess we succeeded.
Well, you know, what is intriguing to me is your descriptions of you and your father working, his ideas and so forth, and the way that you speak of him. I have a wonderful relationship with my father now. It took a number of years to find that connection, and it was funny because when I first started getting into computers in the early and mid-90s, my biggest fear was that the computer was going to be the one thing that was going to drive people into isolation, away from each other, and separate them. And in fact, it actually had the reverse effect on myself and my father, in that we have that kind of connection, and then others as well that have developed over the years. And my father's in his mid-late 70s. I used to get excited when I would tell people, oh, my dad's 70 years old. That's so cool. And and it's now he's in his mid and upper 70s, which is also very cool because he's still around. He made the comment to me, says, well, I didn't expect to live this long, but I am glad I'm here.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
He was very excited about that. But you speak of your father and your relationship with not only excitement and enthusiasm, but also with a warmth. I would take it that was something that really was, if you will, cemented, the wrong term there, but it was really solidified, if you will, between the two of you over the years, and you still have that, those memories and so forth.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because as father and son, we weren't that close. My father was really a genius, and I don't use that word really freely at all, in that he invented a new style of architecture. It's now called postmodernism. To him, it was just simply fun architecture, designing actually for people to enjoy. Up to then, there had never been buildings built that people were meant to enjoy themselves in. As most people who have that much talent, and he was a great architect. I'm a good architect, but boy, he was terrific. It was only when I became an architect that I was able to really understand the man. And we could then communicate as two architects because I was so in sympathy with what he was doing and could appreciate what he was doing that we then became incredibly tight, which we had never been as father and son, but as two architects, we kind of had the same mental process. I learned from him to some extent. He learned some of the tricks from me, but it was his idea that buildings should be places for people to enjoy their lives. That I respected. My God, this man really hit upon something that is so obvious but had never been thought of before.
And you know, that's interesting that he came up to that conclusion, because that's what most everyone we talk with on this program, when we ask them, so what do you think the purpose in life is? And 9 times out of 10, the answer that comes out is to be happy. Or you can translate it into have fun if you want, but it's the same thing. To enjoy who you are and what you are and where you are. And where you're going.
Well, I had a professor in architectural school who became a dear friend of mine named Eugene Raskin. And he was one of the wisest people I've ever known. And at one point he said to me, at one point he used the example that he had a thriving architectural practice and we had made enough money, he closed the architectural office, took the money, bought a sailboat, and he and his wife sailed around the world. And people said, how could you have done that? And his answer was, if I don't enjoy my life, who will? I've tried to live by that.
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, and as a sidebar, by the way, Gene finally retired from teaching in architecture because he loved music, and he wrote a little ditty called Those Were the Days.
Oh, I've heard of that somewhere. I can't remember where, but I've heard it.
It was one of the few songs ever to be on the hit, on the top song in 11 different countries.
Oh, my gosh.
He was a wise, wonderful, wonderful guy. And his other precept in architecture was when people said, you know, if somebody wants you to design a building and it's really bad, you know, do you really do it? You know, if they want to do a cheap building. And he said, look, you have to live with yourself. And he said, the only precept I've had for myself in architecture is that when I look at myself in the mirror every morning, I just want to feel aesthetic disgust, not moral disgust.
Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever in a day.
Absolutely.
We'd live the life we choose. We'd fight and never lose. Those were the days, My friend, those were the days.
Absolutely.
And these are the absolutely. This is great fun. Tell Me Your Story is the name of the program. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. My guest is Alan Lapidus. He's the author of, well, of course he's the author of his own memoirs. Everything by Design, My Life as an Architect. And as I began to prepare for this interview and I spoke with the folks there at the PR firm and in setting this up, I began to think about that in terms of Everything by Design. And I'm wondering, not to get into necessarily any theological discussions, but from your perspective, obviously you have an intellect that allows you to put together all of the things you've learned over the years to design those images in your mind. And as they say, everything begins with a thought. What is your perspective? Is there an intelligence out there, a divine architect that has made this pretty incredible?
Well, it is. I think it's a sense of humanity because in architecture, you're being arrogant. You're impressed. What you're doing is you're putting your vision of how people should live on the earth, and they have to do that. So it's something that you don't take lightly, and I think most architects, after they've been seasoned and matured a bit, realize they're imposing their vision on people for a long time. And it does cause a certain humility, but it also causes you really to think about people and to analyze them and to understand them, because unless you understand people, how are you going to design for them or design successfully?
Mm-hmm.
And, I think probably the greatest examples of this are, of course, religious structures, which understood from the very beginning, from the great Gothic cathedrals to the Greek temples and the Roman forums, that they were using buildings to, for better or for worse, affect people's lives, and they did. And then in our day, the office buildings, I think, are getting better, but I loved designing resorts, hotels, and casinos because they were buildings for people to enjoy themselves.
To have fun, exactly.
And to have fun. And the nice thing is that when they're open, you immediately knew if you succeeded, because if people... I love to hang around a hotel that I did after it opened quite anonymously, and because when people go to a new hotel or resort, they talk about the resort, and you get instant feedback of, you know, it's okay, it's a pain, it's this, or, oh, did I have a great time, oh, the rooms are terrific, or and, you know, I can then improve because I listen to what they like and what they don't like. And so it's a wonderful privilege to be able to do that. And the two fields that were most demonstrative of what of success or not, my two primary clients in the last 20 years, amazingly, have been the casino industry and Walt Disney. And because both of them are trying to achieve the same thing, which is to create an environment where people can shuck off their everyday existence and fulfill their own fantasies. At Disney, it's the wonderful world of Disney and the wonders of Main Street USA and all the wonderful attractions, and they lose themselves. They don't think about their job or a coming midterm or things like that. They are surrounded and enveloped by the experience. And interestingly, it's the same thing we do with casinos for their grown-ups. They enter a world unlike it's a hotel and a resort should be no place like home. And the casinos do it much the same way Disney does, to create a seamless environment where people can live out their joys, their fantasies, and just have a great time. It sounds peculiar to equate Disney with the casino industry, but they really do operate along the same principles.
Well, I think it's remarkable that we have folks such as yourself and your father who understood from very early on, especially in this country, as this country hasn't really been a real mecca of spirituality, but nonetheless, we have little pockets every so often we come across them, such as yourself, Alan, and your father, who understood, even if you maybe weren't great religious men per se, you understood the spiritual concept of being happy. I can't remember the name of the gentleman who sang it, but don't worry, be happy.
Happy, right, exactly. It's such a privilege, really, to do this because when it works, it is such a joy. And one of the things I did at one point for a pro bono job when the city of New York asked my father and I if we would design a swimming pool and recreation center for Bed-Stuy, which is the poorest ghetto in New York. And they said, would you do it for free? And my father looked at them and said, that's where I grew up. Of course I'll do it for free. You know, and he said, my swimming pool was the East River, where we used to dive off the docks. And so we created a sort of fantasy land with no money, by the way, because the city budget was appalling. But just by ingenuity, we created something which transformed the neighborhood, where people just, where the kids, instead of getting into trouble on the street, had a place where they wanted to go, and they wanted to be there, and they wanted to play there. And, you know, the crime fell off, and kids suddenly realized there was a world outside of these dirty streets. And we made an impact, and we made a difference, and that's the most biggest reward you can get.
I'm curious, you talk about you and your father designing buildings in the concept of having fun and being happy, and I'm wondering, have you ever considered or taken into consideration other philosophies? And the one that comes to mind most right now is the concept or philosophy of feng shui in terms of designing buildings. Should the front entrance face a certain direction versus the back entrance? Should it be a certain shape, square versus octagonal versus triangular, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Are any of these philosophies anything that you take into consideration when beginning this process?
Absolutely. Now, feng shui is the ancient Chinese herb of idea of design, is based, like so many things, on common sense and the orientation of a building. You know, they said that never have a doorway open into a room; you always go around something. Well, you know, yes, that's spiritual and that's fine, except it also makes sense so the wind doesn't blow through the living room, and you orient it to the prevailing winds and the various light forms. And that's the way a building should be designed. And a lot of these things like feng shui that have sort of been regarded as mysticism, once you peel back some of the verbiage, you found some really smart design ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that's wonderful, and I know that there are more and more people and architects that are in the process of incorporating these, and I'm hoping too that even some of the architectural schools that are teaching the new architects up and coming, they're teaching them to incorporate many of these things. And you know, it would be, it's funny, you know, we hear a lot about global warming and all these different issues, my perspective is, you know what, I'm going to disregard the fact that there is even the concept of global warming versus even the other philosophy that we're actually headed for the next ice age. I just think that just from a common sense standpoint, a practical standpoint, we should be doing these things because they benefit us and the places, not just the buildings, but the planet itself, the environment in which we live. It just benefits us all the way around. It just is a better way to do it. It doesn't make any difference whether, you know, we're, you know, hurtling towards catastrophe. Even if we weren't, let's do it.
It, common sense, thank heavens, is coming out at last. And well, common sense will always rule.
Absolutely. Well, Alan, unfortunately, on these kinds of programs, as you know, being in radio some time ago, you also know that the clock tends to rule us, and we're fast approaching the end of our program. I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and your visions with us, both here on the program as well as around the world. People can take a look at your buildings and pick up a copy of the book if you'd like to know where some of those buildings are. Everything by Design, My Life as an Architect. And Alan Lapidus, I thank you and your father for being a part of this program and a part of our lives.
It's been a pleasure.
Stay on the line if you would. I'm Richard Dugan, and I want you to stay with us here as we continue talking about new paradigms for a new world. And next week, we have a gentleman who's going to be joining us. His name is Dr. Eric Pearl. I've had the opportunity of interviewing him in the past as well. And he has discovered the reconnection. It is a form of healing, of using those energies that are all around us to help the people that have come in contact with him. And he's going to share his ideas and concepts on healing and living a happier, better life through the reconnection. We'll be talking with him as we continue moving forward here on this program. It's called Tell Me Your Story. It is a program designed to give you choices and give you knowledge of those choices to fulfill your dreams, your aspirations, your desires, whether you, and I found this so fascinating. I was watching a program the other night having to do with what makes people happy. And they went to, as Alan mentioned, Denmark in particular. They went to Denmark, and the people there, they're all basically of the same economic class. And the garbage men loved being a garbage man and didn't mind being called one and not a sanitation engineer. Loved it. And he made people happy. And if he could do that throughout his day, then he was a happier person, even the people in the hospitals and in the factories and what have you. Fascinating. So that's why we're here, to help to bring you happiness through these programs, through this information. We hope that you will join us every Saturday at this same time, 11 o'clock, Saturday mornings, for Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and I hope that you will go to my website, richarddugan.com. Email me at richard@richarddugan.com. Love to all. Have yourselves a great Saturday.